Okay.
Matthew.
Yeah. How you doing, Andy?
I'm just looking forward to this hot goss.
Okay. Well, I did a little prep for this episode and I came prepared with props.
Props.
And this is, in fact, genuine blueberry, wild blueberry jam.
Mad props.
Thank you. Thank you. So this is the most prepared that I've ever been for a episode recording. Fun fact.
It is. Usually I just, it's like a bonfire.
Both bad.
Both bad.
No.
Barn fires are worse than bonfires.
Yeah,
We'll say
that's
that.
True. Yeah. I guess bonfires aren't bad at all.
There are certain barn fires that are good, but that's usually related to the people who own said barn fires,
yeah,
or barns before fires.
I guess it's kind of a two-axis thing, because there can also be bad bonfires.
Yeah.
Or maybe bonfires done by bad people. I guess the bonfire has no morality. What are we talking about today, Andy?
Bonfires, actually. That's it. No, today we are talking about blueberries. Not canning blueberries, but blueberries.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. Hello, everyone. Today we're talking about blueberries. Everyone knows what a blueberry is, right? Yes, no, maybe. I'm going to assume yes. So there is Matt about to say no? Please tell me no.
I was going to say, I don't know. I feel like the description of it just a name is pretty good.
It's a berry. It's blue.
You get most of what's going on there. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot you need to add to that. Like, it's a berry. It's blue. Congratulations. You did it.
Except I guess this guy wrote a whole episode about what to add to that.
Yeah, this fucking guy. So yeah, everyone knows blueberries. If you live, I think, mostly in the northern half of North America and on the East Coast, you've probably been blueberry picking before. If not, it's a great time.
If not, what are you doing?
The thing is about blueberries, they've only been on shelves in recent memory. And that seems really weird, right?
Yeah, that is strange.
Right? The question is then, how did they get there? That's what we're going to talk about today. So longer history, right? Because this is the Poor Poles Almanac and all we care about is 10,000 years ago.
Get ready for the Ice Age.
Based on pollen records, we do know that blueberries have been managed and harvested for at least 10,000 years. Historically, harvesting season for anyone that's harvested blueberries, it's a little bit of work. It was kind of a communal effort when it was blueberry season. The harvesting period was always like a time of celebration, story sharing, getting to see family that you otherwise wouldn't see because it was like, oh, it's blueberry. Everyone goes to where the blueberry patches are. Hey, it's Carl. Buddy, haven't seen you since last blueberry season.
Has it been last blueberry season already?
Exactly. If anyone's used a blueberry rake, they were actually based on these special combs that were made by indigenous people. And they were made out of wood or fish backbones. And they basically strip off the blueberries with, like, if you've ever made like a really like hood version of one, it's just like nails and a piece of wood. Like get the like long ass like 3-inch nails, put it on a piece of wood and like stick it on a bucket. Kind of the same thing. Not as good, obviously, but it kind of is the same thing. In the Pacific Northwest, women often actually owned, quote unquote, the berry grounds. And the fields were often named after the trails connecting them. So that's how people knew who harvested where and who was responsible for managing it and so on and so forth. Blueberries were so important and honored that like special people were actually selected for the first gathering of berries. And that was based on skill and knowledge of the plant to the extent that it became like a point of contention with early missionaries.
I can see it. You've got these blueberry fields that you've been working since as far back as your ancestors can say. And these other guys come in, they're like, I want to be the blueberry king. I wouldn't take kindly to that.
They actually were like mad because the indigenous people didn't give a shit about the missionaries, like religious stuff during blueberry season. They're like, sorry, we're going blueberry picking. They're like, God needs you. And they're like, no, blueberries need me.
Blueberries come above God for sure.
Yes. Holiness is next to godliness is next to blueberryness.
And I'm going to hear a playback of this episode from St. Peter at the Pearly Gates. He's like, that was a big fuck up.
How about them berries?
Yeah.
That's a niche Matt Damon reference for those who are under. Yeah. How about them apples? Do you know what that's from?
Yeah.
Are you too young?
No, I was going to say, I feel like Goodwill Hunting's, I mean, it's from Goodwill Hunting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's a
That's,
pretty like mainstream.
I mean, yeah, but how old were you alive when that movie came out?
Probably not. No.
Yeah. All right. That's my point. All right. So back to blueberries. It's worth noting that on the West Coast, and this is important for us to continue this conversation, that the blueberry is also known as the huckleberry, which can be confusing given that huckleberries are a thing on the East Coast, but they're not blueberries. They're quote unquote true huckleberries. Like, way to fucking go, West Coast. For the purposes of this episode, if we talk about huckleberries or quote it, we're talking about that like West Coast blueberry, not huckleberries that you would harvest like 3 weeks later here in New England.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how anyone could ever get those things mixed up. I mean, like, huckleberries are huckleberries, except when they're blueberries, which are also in the same family as huckleberries, which makes sense, like, given that whole pawpaw fiasco a couple weeks ago.
Ah, the pawpaw pawpaw of 2024. How could we forget? Hard times.
Mark the calendar, folks.
So in 1615, Matt's best friend, Samuel de Champlain, the founder of French,
me and the bestie.
Besties, founder of French occupied Quebec, was the first white dude. We're going to call the French white people moving forward.
Chocolate bleu.
To record indigenous use of blueberries, observing Algonquin women as they dried what he called blues in the sun. He noted that they prepared a bread of sifted cornmeal.
We didn't call them blues.
We should call them blues, well, right?
He probably called them something in French, right?
No, it was probably blues. I'm going with that. I don't know if it's right. I don't speak French. So he saw them making like this bread, and what they did is they actually included dried blueberries, which is, you know, something we should probably do more of.
Yeah.
The blueberries were used for like a bunch of stuff, like pemmican, which many people are familiar with, which is basically like a protein bar kind of thing. Roger Williams, well-known dude for the worst state in Massachusetts, Rhode Island. Yeah, fight me on it, all right? He also saw the same thing, that the blueberries were harvested, they were dried by the indigenous people, and that way they were preserved for the year, some of which they actually beat to a powder and would mix like with their meal, that they'd make like an acorn meal, cornmeal, whatever it was. And he was like, basically, like they're like this cool little thing that they add to food, and it's sweet and delicious.
Sounds really good.
Doesn't it? We should be using blueberries in more stuff, is my thought, right?
I was going to say, we should try to make some.
I got a little blueberry pilled on this episode, I'm not going
to
lie.
Oh, yeah? I'm trying to think. Something you're bush maxing.
Blue maxing.
Blue maxing.
Yeah. So our BFF, Henry Thoreau, noted John Brown obituary writer, Henry Thoreau, also took a very special interest in blueberries, writing extensively about it, including an entire unpublished manuscript called Wild Fruits, which contained like a large amount of citations about the indigenous use of blueberries, to the point where his unpublished manuscript is very heavily cited in most research on blueberries, which I've read basically all of it now. So congratulations, I can confirm that. He wrote, and this is a quote from the book, "From time immemorial down to the present day, all over the northern part of America, the indigenous have made far more extensive use of the whortleberry," which is what they call the blueberry,
"oh, I like
at all
that.
Seasons." Whortle, that's a mouthful, man.
Whortleberry?
Yeah.
I guess it'd be hard on people from New Jersey.
The waterberry?
The whortleberry. Sorry.
The extensive use of the blueberry at all seasons and in various ways than we, and that they were far more important to them than us. So that's his little thought on, like, we don't appreciate the blueberry. These people get it. He was also blue-pilled. He was berry maxing, as one might say.
Yeah, one could.
One might say that. Now, while the indigenous dried the fruits to enjoy throughout the year, colonists, being what we do and what we do best, ignoring how people manage things traditionally, decided that we would just can the fruit. And by the end of the 19th century, Picking would change both as a social practice and as a social meaning. So basically, what happened, sidetrack here a little bit, canning became much more popular during the Civil War because, you know, supply chains were falling apart. People needed new ways to be able to, like, access foods, yada, yada, yada.
Weren't they also, like, kind of, like, canning their dead bodies, too? Isn't this when the whole, like, embalming took off?
Yes, embalming took off during the Civil War. Little drop, Death and Friends has an episode on that exact subject about whether or not they were pickling their bodies. And the dude who invented embalming, his last wishes were that he was never embalmed, which is just like a, what else is there to say after the guy who created it's like, please don't do it to me.
Yeah, honestly, I don't want to either. That it feels nasty.
Fair,
and bad.
Fair, right? So while our embalming buddy was doing his thing, he was pickling people. These people were pickling foods, not actually pickling, but metaphorically pickling. Canning goods, canning improvements, like, basically started taking off in the late 19th century. And this was partly because of the meatpacking industry trying to scale and expand its products west. So while canned goods were still difficult to buy, the canning industry itself allowed a lot of rural households to start preserving what they could on site. In 1888, the Ball Brothers Corporation upended the market by producing a fully automatic machine for making canning jars, which cut the price, making canning far more accessible for homesteaders, revolutionizing America.
And, fun fact, the guy who invented the ball jar died penniless.
Not sure what's fun about that. Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
Okay, I'm gonna crack my jam.
Let's crack that jam.
I feel like, is this a good point in the show to crack the jam?
You know, it's always commercial jam cracking.
And I've always said that. I'll do a little ASMR for the... Man, it's on there good. Did you hear that?
I did hear that. It's so sexy. The way that jar opens. I can't even stop thinking about it.
No, that wasn't the sound.
So this is a little teaser for an upcoming episode. It's just ASMR. That's the whole episode.
We're branching out into ASMR. This is the most special kind of blueberry jam because it's not homemade and it's not factory made. It's made by a humane extension agent in an office.
That's how you know it's the best. How is it?
Mm-hmm.
Does it taste like disappointment and failure?
No, it tastes beautiful. It's really good. Mm-hmm. Shout out blueberries.
Okay. Gotta be my favorite gender. Anyways, across Maine, where Matt is right now.
They don't know that.
They don't know that. He could be in Maine, Australia. That's a place.
Mm-hmm.
You may have heard that Maine has a lot of blueberries. The fact that they have a lot of blueberries is actually predicated on a long history of burn cycles from indigenous people for generations upon generations. Before the modern canning industry kind of erupted during the Civil War era, blueberries couldn't really travel other than by using tin cans, which could be done, but didn't have the shelf life of canning as we think of it today. So, like, they were tinning the blueberries and then sending them to places like Boston or New York. And that was about as far as they could get. By the 1860s, men were, according to the Portland Daily Press, making, quote, a snug fortune from the product of these plains.
Wow, what a descriptor, a snug fortune.
I want a snug fortune.
Yeah, me too. But they don't have that today, which means only good things have happened since.
Obviously. The interesting piece of how blueberries in Maine fundamentally shifted comes back to this story from 1870. This dude named William Freeman sued another William named Underwood. Well, William Underwood. So you got William versus William. This guy, William Underwood, owned a canning factory, and it was near 70,000 acres of wildlands that William Freeman owned. William Freeman was basically like, this is all blueberry country, and it's my land, and you're stealing my blueberries. And you keep setting the woods on fire so that the blueberries keep producing, but that means I don't get to harvest any potential timber. So, like, you're destroying my land, stealing my property, and I'm not getting anything out of it. So, frig off, basically. The court sided with him, saying, basically, yeah, you can't just manage someone else's land just because you want to. And that began, like, a new system of leasing and payments that kind of became the foundation of modern Maine blueberry production.
Oh, good. Love that for us. What a good use of courts.
The rich man versus the rich man. What could go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Now, unsurprisingly, landowners squeezed profits from canneries, and suddenly other industries wanted their share of the pie.
Blueberry pie?
The blueberry, yes, wanted their share of the blueberry pie.
That's
now,
better.
That's isn't it so much better when I said that? It's like, let's just pretend you never said any of that. So the Maine state government canceled permits that allowed blueberry picking on public lands, especially when, like, other permit holders held, like, timber or grass rights, so, like, grazing, things like that. So basically it was like blueberries were at the bottom of the barrel of the, like, proverbial hierarchy of land access. Penalties were placed on trespassers of anything that was considered, like, quote unquote, improved blueberry ground. And it basically was like a part of that shift of foraging rights across the East Coast that we talked about, like, 100 episodes ago.
And I mean, as I recall, only good things happened after that.
Exactly.
You know, I feel like enclosure is always positive and fine.
Good.
Yeah.
Enclosure is good, actually.
Fun fact.
Fun facts. All the good fun facts today. So in 1880s, the blueberry rake was adopted. So for you guys, like we said, we're talking about the blueberry rake that people use today, where it came from. This is around when it started became like popular. It was basically a modification of the cranberry rake, which increased production from like 1 to 3 bushels without, surprise, surprise, increasing wages. Despite the stories and the glamour from the newspapers about, like, all these profits being made from a few days worth of work, the reality was not that good.
I don't mean to sound like researching isn't a lot of work, but sometimes it does feel like just the same story again and again with different names and faces and plants.
Yeah, there's just a lot of exploitation. It's just like, it's the whipped cream on your blueberry pie of American capitalism. It's beautiful. You wouldn't change a thing. So that's the story on the East Coast. Now we're going to shift gears a little bit, go to the West Coast. The story of the wild blueberry out there played out very differently.
So no exploitation this time?
Different exploitation.
They say a change is as good as a rest.
So not only were homesteaders out west canning fruit for their own consumption, but they were also doing these, like, weeks in the mountains to take, like, berry picking working vacations. And this is particularly popular in, like, the early 20th century, between, like, 1900, 1925. So homesteaders would, like, fill up buckets to bring home. They would meet tons of people. There were a lot of indigenous people that were still, like, going to those same fields and harvesting berries as well. But by the early 20s, we talked about, like, canning and stuff, commercial sales had begun in eastern Montana. And part of this was because there are already 2 canneries that have been built in the region to process apples and cherries. Now, using these wild huckleberries were an additional product that they could process between the windows of the apple and cherry season. So it was like, why not, right? And at the time, you know, they were freely available fruit on public lands. They required no maintenance or management. They could be picked under the Forest Service's free use policy, so they didn't have to pay anybody. It was just literally show up with a bucket of blueberries and we'll give you X amount of dollars. So, and then lastly, as Matt's enjoying right now, they preserve well and they only really require sugar for canning. So it's like a very easy, cheap, scalable food that was just like waiting for them to take advantage of.
Oh man, what could go wrong?
What could go wrong? We're going to find out. Despite what may appear as widespread wild blueberries in regions like the Pine Barrens today, these fields are disappearing today as tree canopies have become thicker. And this is largely because of like a lack of prescribed burns across much of northern North America. Yeah, I know it sounds like I'm switching gears, but I promise I'm getting there. My point here is that these lands require certain types of management for blueberries to be these wild like patches that could be harvested at this scale, right? And the thing is, like, today we're always talking about how, like, when the enclosure of, like, environmental conservation, that the landscape was enclosed and there's no more management. A lot of people at this time, even in the early 1900s, understood the role of fire in blueberry management. Due to the massive wildfires and the Great Burn of 1910, much of what had once been managed huckleberry acres had been re-cleared so that as this time was where blueberry picking was growing with canning, by 1928, the northern region of the Pacific Northwest was basically in its peak prime huckleberry picking, like, excitement. Like, canning and, like, the peak of this restoration of the landscape were, like, perfectly timed for like the industry to just fully exploit like beautiful fields of blueberries, huckleberries, waiting to be picked. The other piece of this that was like perfectly timed is that after the Great Burn of 1910, the Forest Service put in all these roads to be able to access different parts of the forest. So different parts of the forest so that like if there was a fire, they could get anywhere quickly. But now you've got like easy transportation to like where all the huckleberries are.
I mean, it sounded like it's all just, like, really coming together for, I was gonna say a blueberry bonanza. A huckleberry hurrah.
I like huckle hurrah. I like that. That works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, something else came in 1928. The stock market collapse.
Oh, yeah, that also came together.
Came together. No notes. Mm-hmm. 10 out of 10. Yeah, so that old thing. What this meant was that you had this entire new labor force that like couldn't find a job and knew how to pick berries as like a hobby for decades. Now, according to a good friend of ours, A.H. Abbott, who is a district ranger on the Cabinet National Forest, the huckleberry industry exploded at this time. And by 1933, in quote, the value of huckleberries gathered on the Cabinet last year alone considerably exceeded the total grazing, special use, and timber receipts from several years past, in excess of 50,000 gallons. That's a little bit of fruit.
Just a little bit.
At the time, you could sell fruit for 40 cents a gallon, which is about $7 in 2024 dollars, which is like not nothing if you can get 10, 20 gallons of fruit in a day. And like you're going through like the worst economic recession with no social like supports. That's not a bad gig, right? So the industry grew and a lot of people were looking at it as this new potential industry, including two guys named Clifford Weir and John McKay, who developed these harvesting pickers and created cleaning techniques to scale up production. And they were based on those indigenous harvesters that we had talked about before. Their success didn't go unnoticed. In 1926, a guy named A. Holstein sent our buddy Clifford Weir a business proposition, and this is a really interesting quote, to, in quote, give the laborers the best paying job they ever had and the merchants the best fruit they ever handled and still have something left for our trouble.
I mean, it's wild how much like rural capitalism has evolved in the United States.
I mean, it's really interesting to think that like if I were to talk to somebody about like, hey, I want to invest in your thing. It's like, I'm going to make you rich. That's like the whole thing, right? Like, let's make you rich. Not let's help people get the best paying job they could have. Like, can you imagine like going to Elon Musk and being like, hey, listen, I've got a business proposition. It's going to pay people great. They're going to love it. They're going to make so much money. That'd be a non-starter, right?
Yeah.
So like, that's just totally like tells you how far off the fucking spectrum we have gone on like economics. This commercial picking that was going on became such a strong force at this time that like these full encampments arrived during harvesting season. So like it was just like, oh, it's harvesting season. There was like a fucking town that showed up in the woods temporarily that nobody owned. The picker technology that continued to be improved, so like improved production and so on, kind of became like the cultural icon for like regional identity. Like we talked during the summer season, we had an interview about timber towns, like towns that like were built on like lumber, right? And this was like towns built on huckleberries. By the 1930s, the commercial huckleberry industry was the major national forest free use of the time, meaning like what people are going in and taking out that you could take for free. Now, this massive influx in harvesters caused the forest personnel to worry about things like potential fire hazards, sanitation issues, all the other like sketchy stuff that can happen when you have massive transient communities coming in and out, right? The first solution was to create enclosed regions for harvesting with like latrines and garbage pits and all the stuff that could like help make people be safer, hopefully, both like health-wise and so on. But part of this also separated indigenous pickers from white pickers.
I was just thinking about that, like, this is like one thing to do this in like open farmland. This is like a whole different thing up like forest roads and on mountainsides.
Yeah, what could go wrong? So as the 1930s neared its end, the commercial industry had become like an actual industry. Technologies were like getting to the point where it could scale and it didn't need to rely on free blueberries, free huckleberries. Work was being put into research for like the domestication of the blueberry, which we're going to cover in a few minutes. The economy had begun to improve, especially as we started to gear up towards World War II, right? As wartime scarcities began to kick in, you know, gas rationing and so on, gas rationing and then government like reallocation of funding meant like parks were closed. People had limited access to those wild patches. And just basically, the government was like, this is not a priority anymore. You people need to go make bombs or whatever the fuck it is that they told people to do. Now, after the war, the wild huckleberry industry kind of fell off because people were, I mean, it was the post-war boom, right? People were not canning foods anymore. Freezers were becoming affordable. The supermarket was invented. So, like, everything changed after World War II, right? In some cases where the jobs that people had lost were in logging, they had come back. So, like, they were getting jobs that had good pay and the economy was great and everything was awesome forever, as I was told. So, basically, after World War II, the only people that were left that were harvesting were like indigenous people. And there were people that had closer cultural ties to the huckleberry.
I mean, that's like a really interesting part of when we're like looking at our like relationship to these foods is that like what we just covered, what, 50, 60 years since, well, I guess we're like talking about the Civil War. So let's say like the best part of 100 years that this like really like went through like a boom and a bust for settlers. But having this like cultural tie, I don't know what I'm trying to say here.
No, I think what you're trying to say, and I'm gonna white-splain this to you a little bit here, that for white people wasn't a reciprocal relationship, it was extractive, even if
Right.
there were, you know, these peripheral like feel-good pieces of it of like, I did this because I did it with my parents and it was fun for me and it's a skill I have and like I'm reconnecting with nature, but it's still only one way, right? And it's not like a fundamental part of anyone's identity and relationship with the landscape is still predicated on like extraction.
I guess we don't always talk as explicitly about like the role that culture plays in our agriculture as settlers.
Or lack thereof.
It just requires a very different, I don't know, small e economic thinking, or a different logic of being in reciprocity with your environment.
I Are you finding that there's too much fash in fast fashion? This is Carla with Lennon's Linens. We apply the immortal linenist science to keep clothes lasting for decades. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can check out our pop-up shop in the Red Square in Moscow, Russia, and see how long our work holds up with our hand-picked Short King model, the one and only 100-year-old Vladimir Lenin. Wow, look at that drip. So stop stalling and get your Lenin's Linens today. Exclusions apply. See Vladimir Putin for details.
Well, let's talk domestication.
Okay. I love a good domestication story. I can't wait to like fully domesticate my dairy raccoons.
I mean, yeah, that'd be amazing. We have to breed them to be bigger though, so we can ride them places.
Right.
Like, I don't want to get a fucking horse. Give me a raccoon that I can feed garbage and then ride to the store. That is my post-apocalypse dream.
See, okay, I like where the vision's at. But I think you need to think less like saddle and more like sled dog.
No.
You know what I mean? I think you need a pack of six. Still big.
Yeah. Like they got to like triple in size, like get to about 150, buck 50. And then, yeah, I could see like four of them in a little sleigh. Mm-hmm. That could be fun.
Yeah, that could be fun.
Okay, this is totally unrelated. Sorry.
What are we talking about now?
Raccoons eating blueberries, which is just adorable. We talked about like the history of like the West Coast and the East Coast blueberry. Like there's a whole East Coast West Coast vibe thing going on. You know, mm-hmm. Blued wars, as I like to say. At the same time as this is all going on, this dude named Moses, because of course his name is Moses Sapp. He was a logging contractor in Florida in 1893. He decided to like start breeding rabbit eye blueberries on his farm in Florida. While his work started a boom in the Southeast, the industry kind of faded in the region and he was kind of forgotten in blueberry history. That's all we really know. He used to like dig up his plants in like swamps and like plant them back in his backyard. Very, very low tech shit.
And so that's it?
Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah, that's all we really know about the man. You know what? He's the first guy in history that I could find to do this. So I was like, you know what?
Right on.
He deserves his moment.
Yeah.
Right?
Shout out Moses A. Sapp. Definitely not a sap.
King of the saps. Yeah. Would have loved Warren Sapp. And there's like only three people that'll get that joke. Sorry, everyone. So we mentioned the Great Burn of 1910, which was like this metaphorical and literal fire under the blueberry industry on the Pacific coast. Also, the same year, 1910, the USDA quietly published Bulletin Number 193. Matt, I know you know what Bulletin Number 193 is.
Dude, you know I love Bulletin Number 193. It holds a special place on my shelves and in my heart.
Don't even get me started. Bulletin Number 193 is titled Experiments in Blueberry Culture, written by a dude named Dr. Frederick Vernon Koval. Mr. Koval, Mr. Blue, whatever you want to call him, Dr. Koval, some might say.
Dr. Blue.
I mean, I would go by Dr. Blue if I was the blueberry guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he bought a second home in New Hampshire as a summer getaway.
Ugh, this guy.
This fucking guy. He wanted his kids to experience rural farm life like a bougie bitch.
Oh, brother.
Right? And he found some really delicious blueberries and decided he wanted to try to cross them. So he made two selections from these wild blueberries in 1908 and 1909. He crossed them in 1911. The reason why blueberries had never caught on as a crop is because every time somebody stuck them in a garden, they died. And he was like, oh, they just hate domestication. And he realized that it wasn't that they hate domestication. They hate basic soil. He realized they needed acidic soil as well as chill hours and cross-pollination. And with those, he could actually create the first selections, which is where actually most of our northern high bush varieties come from today. So if you've eaten a domesticated blueberry, you can probably thank this guy.
I mean, people knew about acid and basic soils then. Was it just something that was kind of overlooked?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like one of those things you're like, how did people not understand this? But like at the time, it was just like, well, obviously every plant would like better soil, quote unquote, better soil, right?
Yeah, richer, full of heart.
Yeah, richer, full of heart and health. Health, TM.
But, well, and I guess also if they're just like, in the wild is where you get them, and they're there, I guess there's not such a demand. But to add to our list of blueberry heads, didn't we also mention blueberries with Liberty Height Bailey?
Yeah, he did. He wanted us to landscape with them, which I still think is a great idea. And he even actually wrote about the conditions that they grew in, but he didn't ever actually explicitly say that was the only place they could grow.
Ah, that man was a truly unstoppable force. Still chalking it up to him.
Liberty Hyde Blueberry, as we call him around here.
As some of us do.
Some of us do. Now, the thing about blueberries, as we're kind of hinting, that's important, is that they produce food on what would be considered otherwise worthless land. And that meant like an unimaginably untapped market. So in our buddy Dr. Colville's words, he said, in quote, these lands are generally valued at a low price, and the chief expense involved in their utilization for ordinary agricultural crops is the cost of correcting their acidity. May we not more effectively utilize such lands by growing on them crops which, like the blueberry, thrive in acid soils?
I mean, that's a very agroecological position to take.
Quite. He was a visionary when he said this in 1915, and his status as the father of the modern blueberry should be becoming clear that it's not overstated. Over the 25 years that he researched and worked and bred blueberries, he had created about 68,000 seedlings from which his selections had fruited, and about 2,000 acres of named varieties resulting from the work he had planted. The methods of blueberry propagation that we use today are still the same that he had perfected 100 years later. Now, while Sap Hat may have created the first blueberry industry and orchard, like I said, his blueberries were from dug-up selections in the swamps versus Colville, which basically provided a framework for an entire industry.
Okay, and are these plants still around?
So most of the cultivars today still stem from these original experiments. So like I said before, chances are if you've eaten a blueberry, it's a direct descendant of his work, basically.
That's wild.
You mean domesticated?
Yeah. No. No. No, not today, Andy. Today of all days.
Not today. Not on the Day of My Bloobs episode.
Mm-hmm.
Our buddy Dr. Colville did his research, released his findings, and a reader, a woman named Elizabeth White, invited him to her family's farm in New Jersey, where she and her father operated one of the largest cranberry farms in the country. Now, she'd always had an interest in blueberries and thought they had, like, tons of potential, and she just hadn't figured out a way to, like, do that. And she was basically like, listen, if you figured this shit out, you can use my land, you can have access to my plants. Also, like, we're kind of rich. We own one of the largest cranberry farms in the country. Like, if you need money, I got you. So what she did was she basically bribed her neighbors with immortality. She was like, hey, if you find the best blueberries in New Jersey, I will name the selection after you, and you will be forever famous.
Look, I would watch The Real Housewives of New Jersey if this was the average housewife of New Jersey. I mean, cranberries and blueberries, you're just like, what, the queen of bog and acid soil?
And she was actually pretty badass because, like, the people that she knew, despite being, like, filthy rich, she was, like, friends with all of the Italian immigrants who were basically, like, day laborers, like, that worked on, like, the cranberry bogs and things like that. And she was, like, BFFs with them, and, like, they were the ones that are out in the swamps, like, finding these plants for her. Now, by 1916, together with Dr. Colville, they had both transplanted 100 wild selections, only a few of which they ended up keeping. Now, of these, the modern variety Rubo is a selection from her efforts. And that same year, 1916, they released the first commercial crop of blueberries. But unsurprisingly, she was hyper-focused, didn't stop there. She continued to like try to find improved varieties, including an advertisement which offered $50 a piece for wild blueberry bushes bearing berries as large as a cent. And this was advertised in the July issue of Science.
Jeez, $50 in 1919. Honestly, like, everyone was doing plant competitions back then. We got to bring them back.
Yeah, that's got to be like
$10,000. I'll do the math. So I'm really curious. $953.
That's it? I would have thought it would have been more.
Hmm.
But yeah, I mean, we did try to bring them back. Remember we did our acorn competition?
We did.
Speaking of which, we should probably be putting those results out soon. I'll probably post it in the next, hopefully by the time this episode comes out, it'll be out. If not, check out agroecologies.org. Shout out to Farrellwood Nursery in North Carolina for producing the largest burr acorn at 1.56 ounces. And the largest low tannin acorn came from Arlington, Texas at 0.8 ounces, and it was called Maverick.
Hmm.
We're hoping to grow some of these out, so stay tuned.
Cute. I mean, just for context, how big is the typical acorn?
It's like 0.1 to 0.25 ounces. So like,
Jesus.
Yeah, that's 10 plus times for that big boy from Farrellwood. Like that one was like almost like the size of like a small clementine. And even like I said, the Maverick was probably almost 8 times the size of a typical acorn. So shout out to everyone that contributed to the competition. It was awesome to see what people had sent to us. People were sending like little stories about the acorns that they were sending. It was really cool. But we're probably going to be doing another competition soon. Hopefully in this episode, there's a commercial for said competition. We just haven't figured it out yet. If you're doing whatever the thing is on the competition, you got those things, send them to us. We're doing it.
If you have a blueberry as big as a cent, we'll give you $953.15.
I mean, maybe like a half.
You heard it here first.
Maybe like a quarter.
We will do that, listeners. We'll get okay. A check.
All right. Well, the lesson here is be weird with your neighbors, like Elizabeth. Make best friends with all of the recent immigrants and find the best swamp berries.
That's all you can ask for. She was really a woman of the people.
The swamp people.
A swamp woman of the swamp people.
It's what they say about us Italians. We're just swamp people.
Mm-hmm. I've been saying that for years.
So while we don't know how many plants she received from that competition, we do know that like over this period of time, Dr. Colville did develop an extremely expansive program. With all of the breeding by the 1920s, Elizabeth White's varieties that she was growing and selling fruit and cuttings from was down to 6. At the same time, there were tons of news articles coming out about the, quote-unquote, taming of the wild blueberry. And basically, the government was backing this new industry and spending a bunch of money on PR advocating for this new wonder crop because, A, it was also happening at the same time to the pecan, as we covered a while back, but B, it was like a really good industry to fill the gap between strawberry and other berry, like blackberry seasons in New Jersey. So it was like, we have this labor force that needs work. Why don't we grow blueberries? Now, in 1927, White helped organize the New Jersey Blueberry Cooperative Association while Dr. Colville was still breeding bigger selections.
Okay, so what you're saying is that, like, we need to get the government to care about new crops and then spend tax dollars to fund them until people start eating them. We're, like, 2 for 2 on this so far?
I mean, we eat pecans and we eat blueberries, so I think we're onto something. So we got to get them on the next big crop, which I think should be like, I don't know, what's the wild crop you want to see on the shelves, Matt?
I don't know. To be honest, I still like having some wild foods about, but I don't know. It'll probably be like, they'll probably genetically engineer ramps or something.
Oh yeah, ramps are probably going to be one. There's too much hype about them. We're going to talk actually a little bit about this whole like domesticated versus wild crop in a minute. But by the 1940s, we talked about like with the supermarkets, the post-war boom, the blueberry like very quickly became popular across the country. People were planting them. The Blueberry Hill Cookbook came out in 1959, which basically made it so like blueberries could be used for everything. Selections were still continuing to improve the size and seediness of the fruit. And basically, the wild blueberry became, like, out of fashion. Now, in an attempt to rebrand, wild blueberry producers argued that domesticated blueberries weren't even blueberries at all. They were a frankenfruit, similar to the arguments we see about GMOs today. Now, in one main resident's words, whose name is not Matthew, in quote, there is no likeness between the two. And they were like brutal. Like they were absolute dicks about how domesticated blueberries were absolute shit.
Wow.
And like an embarrassment to fruit.
I guess this guy loves his domesticated blueberries, huh?
Loves them, clearly. They would say like the flavor was terrible.
Facts.
And one guy actually said that they'd prefer no blueberries at all over the new domesticated crop.
Facts.
Bold. Bold statement, Cotton.
I mean, how great would it have been to like see these guys get up on their soapboxes and just like talk shit about fruit?
A literal soapbox. Yeah. I was born in the wrong generation because of that.
True. Yeah, you have to use a fucking microphone. You can't get up on a little box.
I don't want to be on a podcast. Yeah. What the fuck? I want to just be in a room with like 18 drunk guys as one dude stumbles onto a table and starts talking shit about like fucking Macintosh apples. Like, Pippins are the working man's apple.
Dude, Pippins
like, that's
suck.
What I want. That is all I want in life.
Pippins are bad.
Bold, cult, bold, man. I'm just, when we do the Pippin episode, you're going to be real,
I
real.
Mean, unless you're making cider, I don't know. Maybe back in colonial times they were this shit, but I don't know. Maybe you'll tell me.
Now they're just shit?
Maybe you'll tell me some different stuff.
It's about to get hot and hot.
Change
and spicy
my mind.
Yeah. Anyways, during the mid-20th century, all this shit's going on. The USDA sees that the domesticated blueberry is like becoming a thing. And they invest heavily in like marketing research and breeding to make it like a staple fruit on the shelves. Part of the reason why the domestication for blueberries was so successful is that the genome for Vicinium is like pretty wide. So you've got southern high bush cultivars, which require fewer chill hours to produce fruit. They allowed us to expand blueberries into warm environments, while we still have in the north the native low bush blueberries, which are like that traditional wild blueberry that we think of today. So you've got like a pretty wide scope of genetics from Florida to Maine, right? It took decades of marketing to make like blueberries like a staple for our shelves. And like I said, the idea that its place in the American diet is only recent, but now is like, you can't imagine not being able to get blueberries, is like really interesting. Like how you just have to move past the recent memory of a culture to normalize something like blueberries. And also points to like the capacity to bring new fruits to market, right? Like if we invest enough culturally with access, resources, infrastructure, that the idea of bringing new fruits to market or new foods to market as a whole isn't impossible, right?
Yeah. And especially, you know, all the better if it's fruits or other foods that aren't absolutely obliterating the topsoil. You know, I kind of like having that around.
I don't know why.
I know.
Fucking pussy. Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, there are a lot of other fruits and foods that could come from quote unquote poor landscapes, poor soils, that I think could be really nice as like part of our diet if we built the infrastructure for it, right? Now, like we talked about the pawpaw, which is an understory tree, is a native tree and can grow pretty close and can grow like under like black walnuts, which are another underutilized native crop. It points to like a way that we can like provide foods for non-humans while also like creating an actual food system that could be on shelves for people here in our own country that come from the landscape around us, right? What's also important about like blueberries is not only are they like great for us, but they're also one of the most important bushes for native pollinators, especially here on the East Coast. So like having a crop that could actually be good for native pollinators would be amazing. One of the interesting things that researchers are working on today to improve blueberries is creating more productive cultivars using what's called polyploidization and in vitro tissue culture, which has developed these octopoid cultivars. Some of the ones that have come out called Biloxi, Legacy, and Duke may completely revolutionize blueberry breeding.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've talked about polyploidy on this show before, but it's still truly one of the funniest concepts to me that you just like you breed them to have more copies of the genes, and it's just bigger fruit. Just more genes, bigger fruit. Or I guess it's like, well, it's like copies of chromosomes, but
yeah,
it's really funny.
It is. It's like, hacker, I'm in. And it's like, you somehow like superpowered the plant.
Yeah. What if we just gave it more?
What if we gave more plant? If we gave the plant more plant and it became mm-hmm. more plant?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like exhibit. One of the things that's going to be a big challenge for the blueberry industry, though, moving forward, is that like with climate change, we are ultimately fundamentally altering the natural control mechanisms for many predators of the plant. One of the benefits of the wild blueberry is it doesn't really, you know, you manage the landscape, but you don't have to manage the plant, right? With domesticated crops, that becomes less and less the case. With native domesticated crops, they tend to be a little bit more resistant, but still adding climate change pressure means that there's going to be more pressure on plants. We have to consider that as we try to build these kinds of food systems and put the blueberry within this like very specific historical context for how we manage it and how we think of it as a crop going into the future.
Yeah, I think one of the like really important things that we touched on is that like our blueberry is recent. It's 100, 150 years that like it's been part of, so I'll say like the settler economy. And that, like, when we're thinking about new ways to do or different ways to do our food system, being critical of, like, that's the way we've always done it. Or, like,
we can do new things with old stuff.
Yes. That was a good summation.
Right. That's what I'm here for. So I get paid the big bucks.
Don't get stuck. Yeah.
Yeah. So go eat some blueberries. Maybe plant some blueberries.
Do it. They make good jam.
Yeah. Don't be limited by the way history has managed our grocery stores, I guess. I don't know. I don't have anything particularly inspiring to say about that.
No.
That said, if you guys enjoyed the episode and you want to see sources, go check out agroecologies.org. All the sources are up there on the article.
Fun fact, listeners, we made it all up.
We did. It's true.
It's all a myth.
It is. I actually just take massive amounts of mushrooms and then let the voices tell me the true history. It's worked out great so far.
Yeah, dude, what the hell is a blueberry?
Blue.
I don't know what you've been talking about for the past hour.
I just love our French guy who's just like, the bleu. That's yeah, all it is.
Blueberry.
The bleu. They eat the bleus. I've offended every French listener today. It's great. Love it. Love that for me.
No way. They call it a Matilde.
Now they do. Not then.
No.
They called it the bleu.
Bilberry. Whortleberry. Oh, yeah.
No, that was your favorite. The Thoreauism.
All time. Whortleberry.
Bring it back. Real ones remember.
So true.
So if you enjoyed the episode, you want to support us, hop on patreon.com. You can do that too. You can also listen to the episodes ad-free there because, you know, capitalism is a fuck and we do what we got to do. I think that's everything. Next week, we got a cool interview coming up, and we're going to continue this fruity series.
Yeah.
We're getting fruit pilled.
And look out for the new Porpoise sticker. Ask me about my whortleberry crop.
Is that what we're going with?
I think so.
I feel like you got to have a really good graphic for a whortleberry. Like, I imagine like a blueberry and a tornado.
Mm.
Is that what you picture? Or is that just me?
I don't know. I just like the way it, I like saying it. Whortleberry.
I think you're just really high, but
I don't know. It sounds like bubbling water.
Anyways, anything that I forgot, Matt? Are we
listeners,
good?
Listeners, let us know if it sounds like bubbling water to you. I don't know.
Listeners,
I think that's
please
it.
Don't.
Listeners, okay. Email in, tweet.
Tweet at us. We don't have Twitter. Well, we do have Twitter. I just haven't used it in 6 months.
Get at us on Slack.
Hit us up on Teams. The Teams chat be fucking popping. All right, we're done here. Have fun, guys.
Bye.